Hi, I'm Matt, and with me is Dominic DeMarco, who is, what city are you in right now, Dom?
I am in Barletta in Puglia, which is the Achilles heel or the Achilles tendon area of Italy on the eastern side.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So
Today, we're going to talk about multi-tenant architecture. So we're going back to the basics for web application architecture here.
yeah, and when you brought up this as the potential topic, I was thinking, okay, this is for this audience remedial, right? And then you put a spin on it, but I thought it might make just a second to talk about multi-tenant architecture. Example, Google Photos slash Dominic is my pictures, Google Photos slash Matt is your pictures. I should not be able to access yours and mine, vice versa, without explicit permission. But I was thinking about this. There's any number of different ways to set this up and configure it and do it, right? So you could do it at the simplest level, if name equals Dominic. Not really true multi-tenant architecture, but you could put IDs and databases. But as you go up the more secure ways of implementing it, you start getting to perhaps databases. And even beyond that, everybody could run on their own hardware in sort of an enterprise sort of thing. You correct me if I'm wrong that multi-tenant architecture has been around forever, but there's any number of infinite ways to implement it.
There's quite a few ways to implement it, absolutely. Yeah. And just to give people a history lesson in case you're not versed in this, go back to the days before the cloud, and you've got this situation where you've got to boot up your own copy of Windows Outlook or whatever, your own file servers on your own dedicated hardware. Then we, so it never would my information touch your information because they're on their own servers that are miles apart from each other, if not further. And so then when we got to this cloud stuff, which was really nice because they had all the backups and the uptime and everything like that, and you didn't have to have the hardware, they had to maintain and upgrade over time. They moved these same software copies to run independently as well. But then people realize there's benefits to having kind of crossover at times, and maybe not with every software, but basically one click. So your information can talk to my information, or look at the giant social networks out there. They run in the cloud, and you want cross-pollination of data. You want my photos to be accessible by you on the other side of the planet and any other friends there. So then at that point, like merge the databases together in a way. They still have to have a way to partition them, obviously, but they bring it all together. So same thing with e-commerce. If I had a store, just one store that sold a bunch of goods, I wouldn't really want to have it so you couldn't access these other goods. I'd want you to be able to search all of them. But then if you had, for example, Google Photos isn't a bad one. I'm trying to think of a more commercial example, but if you had, say, a Canva where I've got my private photos that I don't want the whole world to see or anybody else to see. I got it's my stuff there, my files. Then it makes sense to have multi-tenant. What happens there is you give them their own kind of buckets where they store their data. And there's a couple ways to do it. You can separate out where the data is stored. You get your own queues. You get your own, if you're using Kinesis or SQS, you get your own S3 bucket, maybe your own encryption keys, KMS or whatever, if you're using AWS. So that all separates it out. You could give them their own database as well, having their own database instance. You could do it so you're doing a partitioning and sharding, so they've got their own partition key, and that basically makes it very difficult to cross compare these things or to query somebody else's stuff because you're querying by that partition key. So that's an option as well. So it separates out everything. It's really good for security. It's good for cost management. So if you're doing the partition thing, it wouldn't be as easy. But if you had gave everybody their own database instance, you could see if customer A was banging on their thing, just spamming their stuff with queries, and it slows down that database instance. And you've got your other customers each have their own database instance. It's not slowing any of them down. So that's really nice for controlling that type of experience. Customer A can never inhibit customer B. And if they say, why is my stuff slow? Well, because you're banging on this thing. They say, we want it to go faster, throw money at it, you charge it more, boot up bigger servers. Lovely. Everybody's happy. The problem, though, I guess. All that's but the interesting thing is when we get to the modern era, when we want to train AI models on all that data. So say you've got an agreement where you are allowed to, with contractually, the customer's fine with it, to train on their data in their database. Training one model with all these separated out, disconjoined data sources can be extremely difficult. Now, here's where the modern magic comes into play.
Oh. And this is where it flips from remedial to things that are important today, things that are changing today. The remedial is this is how it was done. And then you put this spin on it of if I'm a massive company that does X, Y, or Z, and I want to use all of the data to train a model, how do you do that effectively in a multi-tenant system where things are following best practices and well isolated as you're talking through separate databases, separate security keys, separate encryption keys, et cetera.
Yes, absolutely. So that's where you use event-driven architecture in some capacity. A lot of times I'd use Kinesis to pump that into a data lake, which would mean Kinesis would pump it every event. You say it's every new event that's added, every update that's made, everything that's changed, you pump that into Kinesis. It then forwards that to whatever your data lake of choice is. A lot of times I like using, especially if it's not accessed all that frequently, if we're just like training something once a month, I love to use a Kinesis to S3 in a Parquet file, then use AWS Glue, Athena, those big query tools to extract that information and make it available to whatever LLM training session of choice. But you take, imagine you've got 50 clients up there. You now are pumping every single event into this giant data lake, which is becoming fairly big, fairly quickly, but it's designed for that big storage and optimized compute. So it's not always running CPUs 24/7, which would be extremely expensive. You could do that with a data warehouse tool like Redshift, but it just depends on the use case. If you're querying this thing 24/7 and always has to be hot, fast, already booted up, ready to go, Redshift or something of the data warehouse nature makes a lot more sense. That said, Redshift does have a serverless one. I have not found a use case where I'm like, let's throw money at it. But I am a huge fan, again, of the data lake with S3 Glue and those things. But then you can...
And you said Parquet file in there. Is that essentially all the data pushed together? Poor analogy, but perhaps you could certain sort of CSV sort of thing.
Yeah, you could slap it in a CSV. You could slap it in JSON. Parquets are optimized for it. I think Apache came up with it. The Apache org came up with that. They're slightly more... It's just more optimized, okay. Less characters, easier to crawl. I'll admit, like the nuts and bolts of the down details, I don't know, but it's, man, like these other, all these tools love that format because it just picks it up like a dream. If you had to parse
JSON, it's a well-optimized format for large amounts of data to be quickly queried.
Yeah,
it's essentially a database file sitting there waiting to be picked up and queried.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So then now you've got access to all that data. You take it, you train your models with it, and you release your models back to your customers, and they've now got whatever AI feature you just trained up.
So with this data lake, then you say if you're not going to use it, if you're only going to query it once in a while to train models, does that mean you also then pull monthly to repopulate, to freshen the data set, the Parquet file in this case?
You wouldn't have to. You just basically, when you spin up a Glue crawler, you're running Athena query, there's no CPUs running at all. And all that does is it boots up the CPUs and it loads the files from S3 and runs through them real quickly, runs whatever query you need to on them. And then it gives you the results and goes back to sleep. And that way
I guess my point is, so you run it this month, you're not going to run it again for a month, and there's a million new events that need to be put into that data set. Does that happen all at one time? Do you do that incrementally?
That's the beauty of designing. So I write about this in the book, 20 Things You Can Do to Save Money on AWS Today, schematical.com.
I did not even plan that segue for you. Beautiful.
Yeah. So it depends on the system design. I've had clients where I come in and they're loading every night, they're loading every event that's ever happened on the platform and they're running through it. And it's horribly ineffective, especially if the events from last month don't change that often, if they haven't changed. What you could do is you could build a cursor, what I call a cursor. So let's just say I query all this information up till today, and I need to know the count or the amount of times you saved a file or the whatever. I build this data set that summarizes all the data up until today, and I save it in there. And then tomorrow I only load the files that have changed since, the files that have changed since then. And I look at this cursor data and I just alter the cursor data. So I've got the information that I need and it's up to date. So it's an art form that you can use, but I strongly recommend that one. I guess another kind of plug here is if you don't know what event-driven architecture is, you should go to youtube.com/schematical. I have several animated videos on that explain how that one works. But
so you're running incremental deltas on the original file versus building the new file every single time.
Exactly. If you have track of everything that's changed in the last month and you've got what I call a cursor, but it's a cache of data that's compiled data from those big long data sets, and you can just alter that. And sometimes you need to run like averages or things like that. Like you could store in a lot of that information the previous weights. How many, if I was just the simplest thing in the world, if I needed to update an average and you're like, oh, I got to upload all the other ones. No, you can have what the average of the last 1,000 files are. And if you've only got three more files, and you can take the average of those and weigh it in 3 to 1,000, basically, and you can reweight that. That's just one example, the dirt simplest one. In reality, there's a lot more complicated use cases than that, but I would start with something like that as your launching point. Good question.
Thank you. So data lakes for training AI is going to be huge, and there's going to be, we're all signing away our rights when we do this, and we also reap the benefits there of being able to use these tools. But much, and you've seen this several times out in the real world, that keys get leaked to GitHub accounts. How long is it going to take, or has it already happened, or what's going to happen perhaps when some sort of super proprietary model information gets leaked out there due to some poor security around a data lake, let's say?
That is a good question. Yeah, definitely shouldn't have poor security around the data lake. The interesting things about these models are that people don't appear to be, at least the big tech, they don't appear to be protecting their models as much as you'd think. They're protecting their training methodology, but they're releasing the models. And I think partially that's, I'm not a lawyer, but you should check out Erin Ogden, my attorney, Ogden Glazer. She speaks on this. She's phenomenal. We should tag her in this. You can't, not a lot of people copyright code. It is intellectual property. But because of the way the thing, these
because
things
are, of the public nature of the data used to train it, makes it almost must be public by.
You don't own the copyright to it if it's trained on data that you didn't technically own.
And so the best you could do is some sort of trade secret, and by that you just could not ever release the weights of the model to the public. Then that would be your trade secret.
Possibly. It looks like big tech's releasing quite a few of their models and then just charging through the nose for you to train or to inference with them. So they're making more money selling CPU cycles by a long shot than they are with the actual model itself. Now, the training for it, totally proprietary. And then, of course, there's they're trained to work with their tools. So you got these new tool calls that we're talking about, and their LLM is biased to using tools that, you know, they say, oh, you should, Google will be like, yeah, use Google Photos. ChatGPT will be like, oh, you should definitely use ChatGPT's payment solution. So they're biasing the models to want to use their tools where they get another cut on. So it's very interesting. I don't want to say if it's ethical, but from my standpoint, they're executing on it with vast efficiency. Again, that's not to say that it's ethically correct or incorrect, but yeah.
At what point does it make sense to switch from just a pure database-driven approach? And the answer is it depends on a million variables, of course, but from just, okay, I've got one big database and I can handle this by running queries against it, to, okay, we need something more, a mission-built tool for doing just this data lake processing of terabytes of information?
That's a good question. It does depend. I've got clients that come to me and they're like, listen, we've got one client, their customer is spending all this compute power and it's slowing down everybody else. Or we've got this big data consumer that's an investor and they're consuming all the data from all the customers, and we need to make sure they've got access to that, and the big data consumer is spamming the database. At that point, it's a no-brainer. That's absolutely when you should do it. I tend to lead towards designing my designs to be more scalable from day one. I'm always looking for a partition key early on, or a way where I can segment the data up as needed. I'm always looking for the way to implement event-driven architecture so I can pump that data into a data lake. Even if I'm not doing it today, it also has the added advantage of decreasing latency, because you can pump an event. Say someone makes a purchase on your store, and then you've got to update inventory. You've got to send out sales emails. You got to deal with the payment provider and all that stuff there. You basically want to have as minimal amount of stuff happening in that request as possible, that request could take 30 seconds, 60 seconds. Well, the guy's sitting there, did my card go through? No, just check the card. You've confirmed the payment. You got the authorization. Then, boom, put it in a queue for a worker to consume, and then send out the inventory updates, and then send out. Then
you don't want your email server to be down to result in a sale being lost, because
you
it's
got
in
it.
The same then block.
Exactly. So I start with event-driven architecture fairly early on most of my projects. It's great for latency. And again, there's just so many benefits to it. And again, I'm going to say, if you guys want to see more, go to the YouTube channel. There's plenty of videos on EDA and ways to make your business or your infrastructure scalable there.
I can honestly say I've never used a data lake. What would one communicate? Does it communicate through standard SQL? Is there another sort of language that you as an individual can go in there? How long until an LLM can actually go in there and find your answers for you from human written queries? Tell me how many people bought the whatever it is this week.
Sure. The answer is for that last one today. They've got all sorts of tools on AWS to do that. I think I just wrote about one for OpenSearch is allowing it now. But Amazon Q teamed up with some of their other ones. Not Athena. Athena is good for SQL. If you want to write SQL and query your data out with it, Athena does that. And what it does is, I believe that it uses Glue, which runs more Python files across these big data scrapbits. You pass that query in there, it runs it through Python, and then has Python understands the query enough to pump back results for you there. So there's a bunch of different ways to do it. You could write a Python script that goes through and scrapes data out of the data lake alone and run it ideally with a tool like Glue. But yeah, AWS Q and Q Business, not Q Developer so much, but Q Business teamed up with, I'm spacing on the name of the technology right now, but I've written about it. It can do a lot of the scraping and extract that data. Q Business is designed specifically to take human readable words like you type and then give you answers like that. So you can start with that.
I see a lot of marketers and sales executives ruling over the ability to go in and ask such questions, where before having to do anything would require technical language, right? You would have to have an exact sort of syntax to your query. So anyways, to be able to go in there and ask very specific questions by just using everyday language.
Yeah. And there's also visualization tools that AWS offers, which of course I'm spacing on the name right now, but I'm dying to work with it. But they've launched a new visualization tool that tries to build you reports and whatnot based off of information extracted from data lakes and things like that. So if you didn't want to just talk to Q about it and get it back in text, you could spin up a whole visual dashboard without having any coding knowledge using this new tool that they've released. And I just am spacing on the name so hard right now.
I just think you saved thousands of hours at startups who are going to be prepping for their upcoming board meetings by doing the dumps. Here's all the financials that I want to see. I want you to organize it like this, and I want you to present it with such and such a template, and it should at least give you a foundation start. It'd be beautiful if you could export it to Canva so I could fine tune it, but I might be asking for a bit too much there.
Yeah, it's probably not too long till they can do that, but AWS wants to keep you on platform, so they probably just prefer you display it with their stuff. Either way, yeah, you definitely could do that. You could use Q to basically export it as a text file of some type that Canva can read, probably an SVG graphic or something like that, and then you can tweak it from there. So you've got some options.
Other thoughts? Today's topic is multi-tenant architecture, more specifically about how you can use data lakes and other things to train big data models using your multi-tenant architecture, et cetera. Matt, sign us off here. Bring us home.
Sounds good. Yeah, like I was saying, this is great for scalability. It's good for cost as well. If you wanted to learn more about the cost stuff, go to a lot of this stuff is actually on schematical.com/free. So you check that out. If you wanted to join a community of people that get coached on this by yours truly, go to schematical.com/community, or it's our group coaching program there. But other than that, yeah, happy to answer any questions people might have on the topics. It's a very exciting time to be alive.
Yes, indeed. All right. With that, we'll see you next Tuesday, Matt.
Sounds good. Take care.